much attention to what the pigeons are doing just because the weather's warm, but somebody in our household is.
Yes, her first spring, and it's rather unusual. It's still winter, and she's having her first spring. And she's enjoying it. Lulu the cat. Hello, yeah. Lulu.
And that's
Hello to the pigeons, too, by the way.
Oh, wow.
Because they're listening. We need as many listeners as we can get. And we'll take pigeons along with the cats, won't we?
Yeah, and that great conductor on the number one
train. That is amazing.
This show told me.
What was that story?
Well, he told the folks from Teresa's Ecstasy, the play we're going to talk about later, that they could get to Wall Street in just enough time to hear his favorite show. I can't get over it. I wish I knew his name.
Yeah. But how does he listen to the radio as a conductor on a subway train, I wonder.
It's got great reception.
Really?
Maybe. I don't know. I've never tried to listen
There's
to the radio.
There's a long aerial that he drags down into the tunnel with him, and it's up there. And
maybe that
you
thing...
You see that aerial traveling down through the air shafts all the way down?
Rattling along.
Down to South Ferry.
Well,
that's
funny.
That's great, because I know a lot of cab drivers are listening to WBAI.
Yeah, they because, do. Those who don't have iPhones are listening to WBAI.
Well, it's legal to listen to the radio, isn't it?
Yeah.
There's some trouble sometimes.
Yeah, why is it legal to listen to the radio? And
well,
not
because
to your...
we had a strong lobby back there in 1929 or something.
Yeah,
it had to be legal. You can't have illegal listening to radio.
What was 29 when they wrote the, laws of radio?
Yeah, well, 34 and amended and so forth.
Yeah.
But 29, they had some broadcasts, and capitalists took over, and the capitalists run the world, and Franklin Roosevelt saved capitalism.
That's right.
I heard that.
Yeah, Lulu, did you hear that? Franklin Roosevelt saved capitalism. These are facts a little kitten should know to grow up to be
because she wants to go into
business. A right-minded cat.
Sell cat toys to her friends.
She's too selfish.
Okay, it's true.
On today's show, singer Loudon Wainwright. We'll talk about acting with the Talking Band, which he's been associated with for a long time. They're doing a remake, new production of Hot Lunch Apostles. Woo, what a play. Yeah. Thumbs up in this studio. We'll be talking later to playwright Begonia Plaza and Catalan composer Albert Carbonell on Teresa's Ecstasy, which is a new play set in Barcelona. They don't say the word too much, but I think they pronounce it right in the play, don't they? Even though some of them are from... Do you pronounce it properly? Barcelona?
Well, I had to when I was in junior high school, but I don't know if I have to anymore.
Now you don't have to. I don't even know if
Why? They forced you to learn Castilian.
I don't know, but that isn't even a Catalan pronunciation. And Barcelona is a Catalan country.
Oh, okay.
So, okay.
Now I know.
Barcelona. Very great city, however. And Dadaists. Cat George. The music stops for the Dadaists. Cat George, Lois Kagan Mingus, and Joni Fritz Zezike. On the 5th annual New York City Dada Poetry and Art Salon at the Cornelia Street Cafe. And also, as a lucky strike extra, we'll be talking fast to Mira, the Mira Awad, who is part of the team of Noah and Mira, Jewish Arab singers who are going to be playing at Lincoln Center on March 15th. So we'll grab a word with Mira. Meantime, these people again.
Ah, look who is here again.
We are back.
Bonjour.
It's the French couple.
We are not the French couple.
We are the couple from France.
Ah, a country famous for its philosophers.
Yes, Descartes, the father of modern philosophy in the 17th century.
Modern philosophy began in France with the philosophy of René Descartes.
I think, therefore I am.
Cogito ergo sum.
No one ever thought that before.
I never doubted my own existence.
That seems like science fiction.
It is what philosophers think about.
The fundamental question is, how is it possible that mind and body interact with one another?
Here, we must say thank you to the Surrealists of France.
Merci. Merci, Surrealists of France.
Surrealists always make things more understandable.
And the daughters, too.
Marcel Duchamp.
André Breton.
Jean-Paul Sartre defined his existentialism as drawing all the conclusions from a consistent line of atheism.
Albert Camus rejected being labeled an existentialist, preferring to be called an absurdist.
Sartre said, we do what we don't want to do, but we are responsible for who we are.
And now we must go. Too soon? That's life.
We do what we don't want to do.
Vive la France.
And there they go.
The French couple.
We are not the French couple.
We are the couple from France.
Welcome, Loudon Wainwright, Grammy Award-winning singer-songwriter who has recorded over 25 albums and whose acting career, I think, dates all the way back to MASH when you appeared as the singing surgeon. Am I right?
Captain Calvin Spaulding, the singing surgeon.
Oh, good grief. Oh, great. I mean, you can't beat that series, can you? Don't, especially if you're an anti-war person, it's always a delight to know that MASH is running when a war is, huh?
Yeah, no, it was a lot of fun to do that, and it was a long time ago. I mean, it was 1975, so I think it was the third season, but it was with, all with the original cast,
yeah.
It was a lot of fun.
Well, I had no idea that your roots, you know, as an actor go back really to off Broadway into La Mama, and that you've been a fan at least of Talking Band, for all this time now, or starring in, well, it's an ensemble production of Hot Lunch Apostles, which has been, singled out for its, in the Brooklyn Rail for serving up religion, raunch, and desperation.
Three of my favorite things, along with snowflakes and kittens.
Well, yeah, kittens. They're exactly like snowflakes. They're all the same, but a little different. So, taking on this role of Barney, you were in charge of a band of low-life actors. This is a play by someone I guess I should have known the name of, Sidney Goldfarb. He's been around a while, hasn't he, on the proper fringes of antisocial society writing.
Yeah, he's a poet and a playwright who spent, I think he originally was up in Massachusetts, but then spent years and years in New York. And, you know, out of that Allen Ginsberg school of things, I'd say.
Yeah.
But also writing wonderful plays.
Well, this play also had a big run in 1983 and revived again in 84. And it was at the edge of the Reagan era, right, when the play first came on. And it's about, you want to describe it in a nutshell, what your little ensemble of schlep-alongs, outcasts from society
right.
are up to without using any dirty words?
Okay. Well, it's a carny, actually. You know, it's described in the script as being kind of somewhere in the Midwest or even the West. You know, a traveling carnival show that does strip shows and geek shows and, you know, kind of burlesque comedy, but pretty cheesy, pretty rough, pretty raw. And times have gotten hard. It was originally written in the early 80s, as you said, to be set in the future, but now we're doing it in the present. You know, there's a lot of people unemployed. So the whole conceit of the piece is that the Barney, who's the character that I play and is the head carny in the carnival, decides that they have to broaden or diversify. They can't just do sex and strip and geek and freak stuff. We decided to do the Bible stories, Jesus getting his feet washed by the tears of the woman, and the crucifixion, and the nativity,
the Last Supper.
And,
yeah.
You know, that this somehow will engage people and bring people inside the tents, and that's his idea, and it starts to work, actually.
It starts to work on the company of outcasts, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
Geeks.
And they actually start to, make some money. And then all kinds of interesting things happen. But it's a kind of mashup of, you know, religion and politics and economics and sex and, performance and...
And Carney, too. A little bit of Carney thrown in. When we enter the theater, the La Mama space is all converted into kind of a freak show. I mean, you know, stalls where people are, there's a bearded somebody and a singing somebody, and you get a chance to throw, you know, do weightlifting. Is that an honest weightlifting device there?
I can't divulge the
secrets.
Yes, of course it is.
You're not out there in that.
I was one of the guys in the beginning too.
You were? What did you do?
Because I had a skull mask on.
Oh, really? Yeah, you guys really go. You do anything, don't you? That troupe. And you know what was fascinating to me? It seemed to me now that I think about the staging of it. Most of the geek performances are played as if the audience were not facing us, were facing in the other direction, and the religious sets were done facing us. And they are really beautifully rendered, aren't they? They look like the director, Mr. Zimmet, has been studying the Renaissance paintings pretty carefully. You do some extraordinary stuff there.
Yeah, Paul Zimmet, who directed the original production in the early 80s and our production, really did an amazing job in general of directing the play, but specifically those vignettes and they were based on paintings, Italian Renaissance paintings and of the Last Supper and the Crucifixion, and they are powerful, I would say.
Powerful. They're like old art and new theater, like experimental theater posing, but really so reminiscent of the artwork itself that it's very striking, very stirring. What's your ease as an actor? Does that just come from being a performer? What's the difference in discipline to you, being an actor versus singing in front of an audience and writing your own material?
Well, acting in a play or on a television show is a much more collaborative, you're dealing with other actors and a playwright or a screenwriter and a director and technical people. And so it's a little, being part of a little family, which is great because my job of being a traveling singer-songwriter is I just travel around by myself with my guitar and
right, even though you have a singing family, you're all booked, right?
We occasionally see each other in airports. So it's great to be in a play because it's performing. It's a different kind of performing. As I say, it's more collaborative and very enjoyable. I've had a lot of fun doing it.
Well, it is fun. I mean, it's fun and it's sobering as well. Many of your songs, or if not all of them, have a kind of social content. They're derived from the folk tradition. And you write about your own thoughts about society. You did one the other night about pill taking as a senior citizen, or an older citizen, shouldn't say that. I don't know what your age is. But it was really very funny, but really telling about what's up in life here, what we're stuffing into our bodies. How do all these words of the other playwrights sit in your mouth? How do you go about that? Is it a struggle to memorize, or is it because the collaboration makes it a little easier?
Well, it wasn't. I have a lot of lines in this play, and I had to work. And my memory isn't what it should be or what it used to be anyway. Mm-hmm. So I had to work a lot on that. I loved. I like the play a lot. I like Sidney Goldfarb's. His whole thing is great. So I felt very comfortable doing it and enjoyed it a great deal.
Yeah, you're sort of like, who could we compare this role to, running a Carney show? Something like, I guess, Howard Keel in The Greatest Show on Earth, right? Running the show, being the head guy, the guy with the boots who makes all these actors do things.
Howard Keel meets Elmer Gantry.
Exactly, right. Because does Barney, does your character believe in this? Is he taken over, or is he just, is he so, what's the word for it, skeptical?
Well, no, he's not a cynic. He's a rough and tumble bastard in many ways. But at the end of the play, he talks about how religion has a new feeling about religion in general. He's not sure about it, but there's a beauty to it. The ideas of it, and the story is quite a beautiful story.
Who plays Jesus? The actor who plays Jesus does very beautiful job of rendering.
His name is Jack Weatherall.
Yeah.
And he played that same role in the original production.
Uh-huh.
There are three people who are in our cast who were in the original production.
Wow.
And then Tina Shepherd and also Ellen Maddow,
mm-hmm.
who also did a lot of the music. So part of the idea of reviving it for the... this 50th anniversary of La Mama was to have do a work that's 28 years old, and also have some of the same cast doing the same roles.
It's almost eerie how this play predicted so much of what has really come to pass, including, I guess, this was the Reagan era, so it was the beginning of the AIDS crisis, right? Beginning of all of that. Ill wind for a homosexual community and for the poor and for the trickle down. It's really everything there, and the religious right was beginning to mobilize.
Yeah. No, it's all in the play.
Yeah,
I mean all those bases are touched.
Well, how does a playwright feel? Does he feel smug, or does he feel a sense of amazement too that he was so had such a great sense of foreboding?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you'd have to ask him, he's been living in Colorado for some time, but I met him the other night. He came to the show last weekend, and I hope that he's happy that we're doing his play, and that I think it has some relevance.
Yeah.
In a sense, he was kind of prescient.
Yeah, he really was. I mean, this is the idea that this group. Had you been friends with the Talking Band, or did you know people in it?
I've been friends with Paul and Ellen and Tina for almost 30 years now, and I've been a fan. I haven't performed with them until now, but I've been a fan of their shows, and in the last 30 years, I've seen a lot of their stuff.
So. I mean, the surprise is that those of us who know you as, you know, for your Grammy Awards and as a star, it's something of a surprise to realize how close you were, you know, you came out of that tradition, but how close you are to all the off-Broadway and all of the, you know, the social life that came out of that, artistic life that came from that, little tang on East 4th Street.
Right. Well, you know, when I started out, you know, I was playing in the little clubs in the West Village, and then, you know, people like Penny Arcade and, you know, lured me over to the East Village. And I went to La Mama and, you know.
So all that stuff, huh?
And all that stuff, you know, the Theater for the New City. And again, because I studied acting in the late 60s at Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh.
No kidding.
I've always been interested in theater and, you know, the Open Theater and the Living Theater and that whole stuff.
There's some Living Theater people here and Carnegie Mellon people sitting in the studio, so everybody's raising their thumbs on you.
Great.
Yeah, this group, the Talking Heads, Talking Band, rather, comes out of the training of Joe Chaykin. It's a sort of offshoot of Open Theater, is it not?
I believe so. Yeah, Tina and Paul and Ellen all did a lot of stuff with Joe Chaykin.
So there's a lot of invention here theatrically, isn't there? There's a lot of casual stuff. There's a lot of crazy stuff too. A lot of use of. Props and costumes in a very original way. A lot of what would you call it? Is there some discipline that you all adhered to?
I can't think of what it would be called. But we worked pretty hard on this. I'll tell you, it was a lot of work and a lot of great.
You could have schlepped that cross around an awful lot.
Oh man,
huh?
We were all carrying that cross.
You got the lion's share of it, though, don't you?
Well, I'm on the cross at one point.
That's right. Everybody looks very dazzling on it, I must say, except Jack Weatherall really, he belongs there. He looks like he belongs.
He's definitely got the look.
Yeah, he does. Well, I want to thank you very much for, joining us here and for doing this part and for, being a part of the off-Broadway community. It's a big deal to have you part of it.
Well, I've enjoyed doing it, and we've got another week of performances, and I'm looking forward to doing it a few more times.
A few more times? Is that all it is? Hot Lunch Apostles.
And that's right. We finish up on the 18th.
And how I, yeah.
So, about six or seven more performances.
So I think hurry up and see it. Hot Lunch Apostles. It's too bad we can't describe what Hot Lunch is because it's just too dirty for words. But people have to kind of work on it and see it too. La Mama, Ellen Stewart Theater at La Mama, the 50th anniversary. Loudon Wainwright, thank you so very much.
Nice to talk to you.
You too.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, it's the 5th annual New York City Dada Poetry and Art Salon. Going to happen at the Cornelius Street Cafe. And it's in conjunction with Three Rooms Press and Son of a Pony. Welcome. Kat Georges, your first time here. Very happy you are the Dada hostess. And, of course, our two Dada friends, our old dear friends, Lois Kagan Mingus and Joni Fritz-Ozeke, who have been here many times with their rigmarole, their Dada rigmarole, and their zany attack on the bourgeois society. Now, Joni, let's set this up a little bit. We want to know beforehand why people honor so much the Dadas, enough to do readings and this new magazine in honor of. Can I take a peek at this cat? Kat Georges has brought with her the new magazine called Maintenant. Number 6, is this supposed to be in French or do we say Maintenant?
You can say it either way.
We can say it in French or English or
either
we can
way,
say
it's
it
fine.
Swiss.
It's Dada.
We can do it in
you
Swiss,
you can do it with
right?
a German accent if you like.
I thought it was Maintenant.
Maintenant? Okay, it's maybe possible. That is it. That's the real estate version of it. So tell us, Joni, Fritz, Zazike. What's the deal with Dada? Why do we love it so much, and why are we drawn to it? When it's so funny and zany and all that? What's the political impulse behind it?
Well, it has an immense appeal to all kinds of people, from children to people who are young, old at heart, or something. And but I think that historically, its importance, of course, is that it was a reaction to the unprecedented occasion of a world war. There had never been one before, and this was a real knee-jerk reaction by artists who were just bludgeoned by what was happening, and they couldn't find anything to say anymore about art. And so they kind of created an anti-art, which it made fun of and extended the range of artistic expression and tried to outrage people. And I always think that there's a great connection to that today, because mm-hmm. now we don't have war, we have wars, and we have perpetual war. Mm-hmm. And so I think that in that way, there is a continuous appeal. But above and beyond that, its presence has been so with us for so many years. I mean, you see it on television, you don't even know it, but they use like a lot of Dadaistic kinds of collage and, mm-hmm. and nonsense syllables mm-hmm. and all kinds of things that come from that sensibility. And aside from that, it's two things. It's anarchic, which appeals to many people, especially the young, and it's just damn funny.
Right, it is damn funny. And Lois, you've also been attached. I mean, both of you women have been part of the, your names have changed, the New York Dadas, the Dada Nini Dadas. I mean, you've had an assortment of names. You've been working.
We want to confuse people.
Right, you have succeeded in doing that. What? Nini and then Nini? Is that New York? Because it's spelled the same way, like main tenant here. Mm-hmm. And you've been working with both new and old Dadaists. What, in the Dada tradition, which goes back to what, Man Ray and Marcel Duchamp and André Breton, who else is Sarah. Part of True Tristan Sara, that whole crowd, David yes, Dozer, that whole crowd, the older Dadas.
Janet Coleman.
Well, we were Dada beatniks. I mean, David was an actual Dada, but I came on as a Dada beatnik. You know, that was where my roots were, black stockings, that's all. There's a big difference there. Yeah, yeah, I don't know. Real Dadas wear black stockings, David, or just those Dave Brubeck glasses? He's not answering. He's a silent Dada. But tell us a little bit about, you know, the difference between historical Dada, and Dada happened in Switzerland and France, and it was all over Europe, really, and here too, when Marcel Duchamp came to the United States, it took off as a very important movement in the United States. But how are people leaping aboard the Dada train, if you can call it so?
I have an answer for that.
You do?
I thought of it on the way over here, not knowing the question. No, actually, there's this famous phrase, Dada is nothing, 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 rien, rien, rien. So if you've got nothing and you want to make something out of nothing, then that nothing becomes something. Mm-hmm. Everybody can relate to that. Mm-hmm. Ergo, old Dadas, middle-aged Dadas, young Dadas, Dadas yet unborn. It's all kind of one big ball of wax, for lack of a better word.
Well, it could be wax, couldn't it?
It could be wax.
Right.
It could be kitten feathers.
And I want to say, I see, as a member of the Living Theater, as is Joni, mm-hmm. That Dada, in a sense, well, obviously, historically, was a precursor to the Living Theater, but I see the Living, I see, you know, what Talking Band is doing, I see all of this
hip-hop.
Coming from, yes, absolutely, and hip-hop, too. I mean, one could rationalize it, but I really do see this real line, this historical aesthetic line that goes back to the Dadas. So for me, it's, you know, everything is everything.
Throwing out all the rules and sort
absolutely.
Of digging into the absurdity of the present.
Yes.
Well, Cat Georges, you're the curator of this evening at the Cornelia Street Cafe, or all evenings at the be all evenings, can it?
No. I curate the Son of a Pony poetry reading series, and this is part of that series. We've done it for the last 5 years. I'm also the founding editor at Three Rooms Press, and for the last 5 years we've published Montenotte, which is a Dada journal of writing and art that's now archived at MoMA Library.
Oh, so, how great that is.
Yeah.
It's so Dada of you to have given me one page of the magazine.
We
it
get
has
all the
no,
rest of
virtually
it.
Nothing on it but the cover.
We get all the rest of it Wednesday, so we're,
okay.
We're
there's
really
a, there, excited. Are, there must be 5 earlier editions of it, right? Which is the one there? I'm kidding you. Yeah, here's the one with the it looks like fish.
Yeah,
on
it's
the cover.
Paolo Pellicini. He's a New York-based Italian artist. And on the cover of this year's journal, we've got a collage by Mina Loy, who was married
thing.
To Arthur Craven, who is the person who inspires all of the work we do at Three Rooms Press and inspires me on a daily basis.
So Three Rooms Press has a sort of mission inspired by an actual Dadaist, huh?
Yes.
Which is?
Absolutely. The mission is to get work out there unrelated to rules, restrictions, or any kind of necessary Ivy League White Tower education-oriented basis. So we have a variety of different things we're putting out. Our new book coming out is by Mike Watt, the punk rock bass player. And I think punk rock especially has a connection to that through line of Dada that comes from, you know, pretty much every experimental art movement of the 20th century can be traced to Dada and the 21st century now, so.
Well, why don't we get some, let's get to it. Let's do some Dada here. Kat, you wanted to read something, a surprise entry into the field of Dadaists. His
sure.
name is?
This is a found poem by Mark Zuckerberg,
who, the Mark Zuckerberg.
Yes. And it uses every fifth word from an open letter about privacy updates that was sent to 350 million Facebook users. I'll just read an excerpt. Great world, thanks. Then the to we you to information. First years that you and work today resolves your when by sense want there. Ask for, well, networks, like grown networks members. This best control percent are so issue. Can then people control? Up regional A, control content only. Your mini for who of upload B by make simpler if more discussing July.
He makes the grade for sure. He's right there with Marcel Duchamp, that man. More data? You got more readings?
We have actually two things. So yeah. Do you have to make a choice?
Well, choose one to start with. We'll see how long it takes.
All right. Okay.
No, there's too much.
We're just trying so much to be kind to one another. I just want to say one little thing that Donna
say
York has performed plays by David Dozier, and
that's true.
Yeah.
Yes.
And they are amazing and wonderful and very Dada.
That's true. You're talking about the King of France or? Oh, there's a number of them you play.
Yeah,
quite a few of them.
Wonderful one with a cat. On. Anyway, here's a real a classic Ugo Ball poem called Caravane, which was Dadaistically also performed by, what's her name?
Mina Loy?
Maria Osmond.
Osmond.
Oh.
You can see it on YouTube. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Okay. Caravane. Io le fanto bambla, oh, fali bambla, grossi gamba, habla, horem, e di gaga ramen. Ego bloico, rustulo huyu, holala, holaka, anlogo bung, blago bung, blago bung, bossa fataka, shampa vula vusa, olobo. Tatagorim, Eshikak Subada, Vulubu Subadu, Ulu Subadu, Tumba Ba Umph, Kusa Gauma, Ba Umph, Ba Umph, Ba Umph.
Great. Yeah. You're hearing the applause, listeners? Go for the next one.
Okay.
Lois Kagan Mingus.
This was written by Lois Kagan Mingus.
Ah.
The Visit to Celery Valley. Sloshing through the cream cheese snow, no minced vegetables there, only kidney stones, he hears the heat pipes gossiping. End all flaw! End all flaw! Zebra mussels whisper in their netty pots, eating celery leaves while copulating. He's in the back cigar, singing, Oh, beautiful! Then, exhausted, lifts up his nostrils and forges forward. No metaphors needed here.
Congratulations. The Dadaist herself. Well, this is going to be obviously a lot of fun on Friday night at the Cornelia Street Cafe. You're going to be doing stuff like this. You're singing and artwork too. You
performances.
Have
we're going to have videos. We have Dada music that we'll be playing. And last year we had full house, so get there early. The doors open at 5:45.
Oh, okay. And another question, I see that Valerie Ustinov is going to be here, and there's someone listed as Dada Daddy, Peter Karloftes, who is here to talk about Pukowski for a short amount of time. And then there are L.A. Dadas and Toronto Dadas coming as well.
And New Jersey Dadas. And also we have a special underground guest, Mike Diana, who was a comic book artist who got censored and was told by the court that he could not draw. That was his punishment.
What do you mean? He was not allowed to draw by a court? Doesn't that violate the First Amendment?
Slightly.
So what's happening with him?
So he's going to be performing with our group, City Scumshot, and there be very nice.
And but he won't draw, huh?
No, he's going to perform.
Is his artistic career on hold until the judge?
This happened back in the 90s, so he's since come around to a new way of being. So
what? You mean he accepted that he couldn't draw
anymore? No. He's gotten through that, and now he draws still. So
he does draw.
They were able
to tell anyone.
Was there any legal comeuppance there for the judge?
I'm not sure, but we can talk to Mike on Friday.
Okay, we'll all talk to Mike on Friday. Okay,
right.
What are we going to ask him? Hey, what's the story here? Did the judge get?
How do you not draw?
Yeah.
How do you not draw?
You're an artist.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Okay, that'll be the question for him. And so, this is a regular cabaret night in the downstairs at the Cornelia Street Cafe. Okay.
That's right.
And after that, you keep doing this, Cat George's, right?
That's right. We keep going. We keep moving on. And we have a number of other different books. Like I said, the Mike Watt book, that'll be coming out in May.
Uh-huh.
And we're going to be just going stronger and better than ever.
And now, one more question before you have to go the way of all Dadas. What is it New York Dada is doing as a performance group with Bobby and the paintings of Charles Mingus or the artwork of and the plays of David Dozer, et cetera, et cetera? Are you in abeyance now? Are you working with the Living Theater mostly, or is the what are all those Dadas doing?
We're spread across the world.
Is that what it is?
But actually, I just want to put in 2 cents about Charles. Two of his, or maybe even three of his props are going to be performable Friday night.
I suspected that, right? What do they look like, his props?
You have to come and look.
Okay.
Dada New York is looking for a producer. That's what's happening to Dada.
Okay.
We're looking
to
do something.
Ready to rumble.
Oh, we are ready to rumble big time.
Okay. Well, anyone who's ever heard him here, really wrap it up. They're just wonderful. So thank you all so much for joining us again.
Thank you, Jenna.
Fifth annual Dada Poetry Reading and Grand Slam of the Dadas.
I'll have a blast.
Thank you.
You will have a blast.
This is Cat Radio Cafe, and I want to welcome, gosh, there's so many people here today. It's great, I suppose. We all have to talk double time, right? I'm very happy to introduce playwright and actress Begonia Plaza. Do I say Plaza?
Plaza.
Plaza? That's the right way to do it, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And Catalan composer Albert Carbonell. Is that correct? Albert or Albert?
Albert.
Albert. And you have been working together on Begonia's play, Teresa's Ecstasy. Now, Teresa is not the name of the leading character. It is the name of Saint Teresa of Avila. And the character that you play, that you've written for yourself to play, is on a journey to Barcelona from the United States, where she lives, in search of more about Saint Teresa.
The Divine Teresa.
The Divine Teresa, and also in search of divorce papers from
settle
her relationship with a very winning husband that she's got there. It's torture for the audience to know that this isn't going to last, or to suspect this isn't going to last. We don't know, right?
Is that what they do?
That's what I did. I mean, let's talk about St. Teresa and her ecstasy that louses up this marriage.
Yeah.
I'm not exactly sure I'm convinced that, I don't know. I mean, tell about St. Teresa, what interested your character, the character you play, and also what interested you as the playwright about this amazing, character from Catholic history who has a sort of Jewish past as well, doesn't
yes.
she?
Yes. Well, that's how the play started. The initial idea was for me to write a one-woman show about Saint Teresa, and I wanted to travel the university circuit and play Saint Teresa, because I was inspired by her life.
You mean you thought you'd make a good Saint Teresa?
Well, I just wanted to share her story.
You'd be a very beautiful Saint Teresa.
Oh, thank you. But it was more about how she affected me when I learned about her. I was writing a screenplay on Salvador Dali and found that he kept her book, her autobiography, by his bedside. So I thought, that's odd, this kind of perverted, extraordinary character, has the Saint's book.
Mm-hmm.
So I started reading about her and discovered that she was amazing. Her background, that she comes from Jewish blood during the Inquisition, mm-hmm. Which is an imperialistic church at that time, and you know, a hierarchical social order where it's male-dominated, and the woman is really considered a defective,
mm-hmm.
you know, being
mm-hmm.
in every sense of the word, mentally and morally and physically. So, and she overcame all of this, I think, with the weapon of prayer.
Mm-hmm.
And so I became very interested in Teresa, and I wanted to play her. And I showed a copy of this first draft to Sean Elliott, who is the actor who
right.
plays Andres.
Wonderful. Does a wonderful job.
He's
yeah.
wonderful,
right.
yeah. And so he said to me, there's no conflict here. And I said, well, I don't find any conflict with Teresa. And I eventually discovered how to create the conflict. And it was through this relationship. It's always about relationships,
yeah.
right?
Well, there's a relationship with her
about
sort
the emotional life of this contemporary human being.
Right.
And so, and how it became more personal.
Well, I guess Teresa's ecstasy is very much connected with, well, whatever is the ecstatic in her life seems to have captured some of the more sexual aspect of religious fervor. There's something very sexy about
exactly.
Saint Teresa, right?
I started to discover that Saint Teresa is considered by many Spaniards lusty.
Yeah.
And sensual and uh-huh. erotic.
Right. Very erotic. That's
even that sculpture by Bernini mm-hmm. in Rome mm-hmm. is the ecstasy of Teresa because of the sensuality and the ecstasy she felt with her love for Jesus.
So it's an easy way to be a very fervid Catholic because you don't lose anything here. You get all the sexuality and, as well as the spiritual revelation and so forth, right?
Mm-hmm. But her mysticism.
Yes, mysticism.
Her mysticism is what it becomes more, the prayer becomes more intense, becomes more real, and it's also more connected to the Jewish religion.
Well, the fact that this play is set in Barcelona, I mean, it seems that it's because it's close to Avila. But Barcelona itself has a very distinct flavor, and Albert, I've said it wrong again. How do you say
it? It's fine.
Albert.
It's more like a Frenchy kind
of sort
like
of a French. Albert.
Yeah.
But are you Spanish?
It's okay. I'm okay.
Is Carbonell a Spanish name? Are you from Barcelona?
Yes, from Barcelona, yeah.
And that the music that accompanies the play is original to it, is your music.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got a very soulful quality, the whole Catalan country. And the music, mm-hmm. the language, everything about it, the political philosophy,
yes.
everything Catalan is very cool. Can you talk about how you wanted to infuse the play?
Yes. Well, first of all, it was an honor for me to be part of the project and to work with such a great cast and a great mm-hmm. group of people. And yes, as you were saying, in Catalan, I think probably because the situation in the Mediterranean Sea, because the history, all the influences that it got there, it makes it kind of unique, a unique space, and it has the influence of the Jewish tradition,
yeah.
the Arabic tradition, and then the Catholic. So I kind of wanted to mix all those in the music. So and I hope it came out. Also the flamenco,
yeah.
when there's a scene when they make the gazpacho on stage.
Oh, and they make the gazpacho.
Mm-hmm.
You should give credit to the actress playwright.
Exactly.
Who
yeah.
not only is an actress playwright and
yeah.
has
yeah.
thought up the idea of having a wonderful
mm-hmm.
composer,
mm-hmm.
but
thank you.
But she actually chops a whole lot of vegetables.
Yeah.
And well, both of you do, but
very
really
talented,
to watch her chop away with
right.
those very sharp knives. And there's also what kind of a ham? A serrano ham?
We actually are using the jamón ibérico, but we're calling it pata negra.
The real deal, right?
The real deal. So there's a lot of native, there's a lot of the flavor of the country that comes up that, and really is part of the landscape of Saint Teresa. And there is an argument, a whole long argument that goes on between the married couple that is in crisis, really, that
conflict.
And it goes to the depths of it. I thought that conflict was going to be the thing that kept them together. I think I was wrong here, Because I didn't know I did think so. I was very surprised
it is what keeps them together in a way, because it's that banter, that intellectual banter that is so exciting, right?
Right, between them.
Yeah, yeah. And the food and the eating and the discussion, which is very, I don't know if only Spanish, but European, where you love to sit down and have a drink and talk for hours.
So it's all the earthly stuff that really keeps them together. But the ecstatic part, the mystical part, goes with she finds someone else.
Well, it's also that archetype of the male macho, where it's, you know, the woman is a property of the man.
Right.
And where change is a very difficult thing to accept.
Right. And what makes this character so conservative that she's kept this marriage for 15 years, even though...
I think it's in us. We're still influenced by these symbols, right? By these archetypes.
Well, what is her...
Or I chose to create an extreme so that we can...
There is another woman in the play. We should make this quite clear.
We have a beautiful woman in the play who is also representative of the nurturing, caring... part of the female, right? And she is supportive. She supports this Carlota's writing. She supports this adventure that they're going on. So it's symbols for me. It's the metaphors. And that's what we ultimately embrace is being with someone who is nurturing, who is loving, who right?
Right.
Love creates equality.
I guess I didn't know I wasn't exactly persuaded exactly because my sympathies were so with the afraid it was with the man and it
I
may just
that.
Have to be that he was such a good actor really
I,
you
no,
do
you but like I love that because he is a sympathetic character and he loves there's a lot of love and that's why there it's not black and white
right
it's all our inner contradictions that are being explored.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's not black and white.
So what do you feel as the mournful flamenco composer? How did you feel about her?
Well,
going off on her own ecstatic journey with the editor that's so nurturing.
Well, I have to say that I felt in love with Carlota more than
anyone else.
With Andres. Although I really like also Becky, her freshness. But, for some reason I personally like these female characters that are strong and they're willing also to move and they're also vulnerable because there's a vulnerability on Carlota's character. And what I could say also about the play is that there are also other music played in that play, which is by Cat Stevens,
yeah.
And I think it's a big soundtrack for the play. It's very meaningful.
Yes.
And also it's beautiful, the transformation of Cat Stevens into Yusuf Islam, right?
Right.
And
so I think that's a
journey.
Sort of a mirror journey there.
Yeah. So musically, also there's a big journey.
Yeah.
And I think that's really well featured in the play.
Well, I thank you so much. You know, Begonia thank Plaza. You. That's a really giant undertaking to be the lead in your own play and to you know execute this so well. This play, Teresa's Ecstasy, is at the Cherry Lane for how long? We don't know yet, really, do we? It might be extended.
It might be extended, but for now till April 1st.
Till April 1st.
Yeah.
So Cherry Lane Theater, is there a special website for Teresa's Ecstasy?
There's a www.teresasecstasy.com.
And Teresa is spelled T-E-R-E-S-A. She's a big saint. She really is.
She really is.
You want to meet her.
She's a hero. She made it happen, I think.
She made it happen. Well, thank you very, very much for joining us here.
What a pleasure being
here. Have good luck here with us.
Thank you so much.
It's still Cat Radio Cafe. It's still run by cats and kittens, and we're just their substitute. people here. I want to welcome Mira Awad. Thank you very much for being crammed in here at the end, Mira.
You I enjoyed every minute.
Oh, that's so great. You're coming to do an interesting concert at Jazz at Lincoln Center on March 15th.
Yes.
You have been singing with Noah, a Jewish singer, and we both come from Israel?
We both come from Israel. I come from Palestinian roots. My father is Palestinian from the Galilee, which is the north of Israel. Mm-hmm. My mother's Bulgarian. And Noah comes from Yemenite roots, Jewish Yemenite, born and raised here in the States, and then went back to Israel at the age of 17. And we've been collaborating for 11 years now. Which is quite an impressive long collaboration.
Yeah.
You know,
you
it
only
doesn't,
look
doesn't
like
happen
you.
A lot.
You seem to be about 11 years old now.
Oh, thank you. It's the distance. You're quite far away. You don't see the little things.
No.
Anyway, in that way, it's a very special collaboration because, you know, there are a lot of collaborations happening, going on. But usually they happen for one song, one record, or one tour, and that's it. And we found such a great value in working together that we both keep on with our personal careers, but we always go back to this collaboration again and again.
So you sing separately, but you sing as a duo also.
Yes.
And where the music comes from, what, mutual roots, or do you feed in with different?
No, we totally bring our own thing.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I bring my own fusions, which are, I am a fusion of my, you know, I was born as a fusion. So of course I bring my own fusion. I bring the Palestinian music together. So I mix East and West in a way. I sing in Arabic, in English, in Bulgarian as well. And Noah, she sings in Hebrew, Yemenite, and English. And when we write together, I mean, it's all of that going on.
Uh-huh.
You can hear all the influences, apparently. I would guess you would hear all the influences on stage. The thing is, we came to work together around 11 years ago when Noah called me to do a collaboration, to sing a duet. We did the Beatles song, We Can Work It Out. And obviously the connotations of the We Can Work It Out title.
Right.
So you already understand where we took it.
Right.
We gave it this Eastern kind of sound and that was the message behind it, that we hope one day we will work it out. You know, we haven't yet, if you haven't noticed.
We have
I think
noticed.
You've noticed.
We've noticed.
We haven't worked it out at all, and we're actually taking... we're taking giant steps away from working it out.
Sometimes it's looking worse every day.
It is looking worse, I'm sorry to say.
Yeah.
But I have to make the separation between the government steps and what's happening on the micro level, on people, individual kind of communication level, which is very different. It's two different things. And I keep my hope up when I'm talking about the micro level, because I think people inside of Israel, you have a million and a half Palestinians living as Israeli citizens, which is not an easy reality.
We are
still fighting for, you know, equal rights and equal existence, recognition of history rights and what have you. But we are citizens. We live there. We speak the language perfectly. We are in the universities. We have jobs. We are in every company you can ever think of. Totally immersed in the Israeli society. So on the micro level, you have people doing collaborations every single day, just by working together in the same offices, just by being there and not killing each other, you know? That's
very,
already something.
Very advanced form of civilization.
That is already something big, you know? So I keep my hope on the micro level, and I think Noah and I have always been very clear on the message, saying that we don't represent any governments and any policies. We come as individuals, as two individuals who happen to have a mic in front of their faces and the power to say something into it, to say that on the micro level, people, individuals, should look for a way to open windows and doors between each other, to spread the word of the possibility of the alternative reality that we can live in. I mean, Israel-Palestine can be potentially a heaven with a diverse, you know, all kinds of people with all kinds of religions and cultures and music and food and what have you. And we haven't
been able to mix it together in the right way.
Well, you sure
yet.
Are trying.
I am sure trying.
I want to thank you. And do you elicit a lot of controversy too, your duo? We don't
yes,
have too much.
Yes, we have.
You have.
We have,
yeah,
of course. We've paid high prices. But yeah. But really, I think we can put everything aside now.
You can
Thursday.
Work it out.
On Thursday, we can put it aside for an hour and a half
and
do music.
Sing
we're doing this with this concert as a benefit for the Abraham Fund. I don't know if you know about it. It's a fund that works a lot in the communication between the Jewish and the Arab community. So it's a big honor.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us here. Mira Awad is going to be performing with Noah. Noah and Mira, the team, will be performing at Jazz Lincoln Center March 15th. You have been listening to Cat Radio Cafe. I'm Jenna Coleman, and you are...
David Dozer.
And whose father are you, anyway?
What?
Lulu's
father. Oh, little
father.
Lulu, and to all train conductors, remember, everyone, take your belongings with you. Please use all the doors as you exit the train, and keep listening.
And watch your antenna. Don't let it get stuck in the grates there up above the ground.
Yes, that's right.
Pull someone's stocking.
Don't trip on the conductor's antenna.
Yeah, or, you know, somebody's
careful.
Shoe could get...
That's right.
Okay. So, stay tuned. We'll see you next week. Pay your pledges. Blah, 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 blah.
Blah, blah,
all
blah,
of that
blah,
above
blah, blah, blah,
to
blah.
WBAI. Ciao.
Ciao.
TalkBack is your gathering place for the free and fair exchange of information and ideas heard here Monday through Thursday from 3 until 5 in the afternoon. I'm Hugh Hamilton. Join me as we explore the issues and events making news across the nation and around the world with expert guests, insightful analysis, and, of course, your comments, questions, and observations. That's TalkBack right here on WBAI New York.
Hi, I'm Tavis Smiley. Join me Sunday, March 18th, 4 p.m. at NYU Skirball Center for an all-woman panel conversation called Made Visible, Women, Children, and Poverty in America, featuring Susie Orman, Labor Secretary Hilda Solis, Randy Weingarten, and others. You can listen live right here on WBAI 99.5 FM. That's Sunday, March 18th at 4 p.m. Made Visible, Women, Children, and Poverty in America, a special Women's History Month event. To register and for more information, visit TavisTalks.com/women and children.
Hi, this is Cindy Lauper, and you're listening to WBAI.
Really got a hold on me.
Public radio. Gotta love it.
Children, this is Reverend Billy from the Church of Stop Shopping. You're listening to WBAI FM 99.5, New York City. It's listener-sponsored, children. It's commercial-free. Ooh, change-a-looyah.
Hi, I'm Tavis Smiley. Join me Sunday, March 18th, 4 p.m. at NYU Skirball Center for an all-woman panel conversation called Made Visible, Women, Children, and Poverty in America, featuring Susie Orman, Labor Secretary Hilda Solis, Randy Weingarten, and others. You can listen live right here on WBAI 99.5 FM. That's Sunday, March 18th at 4 p.m. Made Visible, Women, Children, and Poverty in America, a special Women's History Month event. To register and for more information, visit TavisTalks.com/women and children.
This is WBAI. What? This is WBAI New York. My name is David Dozer. What am I doing here? I don't know, but I'm about to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, you are going to hear next Talk Back with Hugh Hamilton. Here it comes. Oh, yeah?